We have with us once again, live in the studios, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover. Starting with the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah, this week the Seattle Police Department, actually it was the city attorney Pete Holmes who dropped the assault charges against SPD officer James Lee. Now if you don't remember, police officer James Lee was caught on a convenience store video camera kicking and subduing a 17-year-old suspect who had his hands in the air and was trying to surrender to Lee. Lee kicked him in, he said, the thigh. It looked like he kicked him in the groin, took him to the ground, and then it looked like he kicked him in the head from looking at the videotape as well as in the side. City Attorney Holmes dropped the charges after an independent expert from the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission, which was under contract to the Washington State Patrol, looked at the video and looked at the documentary evidence, and he stated that, in his opinion, Lee's conduct was reasonable and followed the teaching of the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission. Therefore,
he was also heard to add, cool.
Yeah. Therefore, City Attorney Holmes decided that, well, we can't make a case. But
what if they're teaching assault?
Exactly. At the same time, the independent expert said, quote, that it was, quote, not the best tactic available, end quote, which leads to the obvious question. Why isn't the DOJ also, the U.S. Department of Justice also examining the state's Criminal Justice Training Commission? Because it seems to me that that's where the problems begin.
All right. Moving on, the city council and plastic bags.
Yeah, the city council came out this week and issued a proposal to ban plastic bags. They would exempt only bags for takeout food, produce, bulk bin food, and dry cleaning bags, and would impose a 5-cent fee for each paper bag used to encourage shoppers to bring their own reusable bags to the store. The 5-cent fee, unlike the 20-cent fee that was proposed earlier, the 5-cent fee would be levied and kept by retailers in order to offset their costs for the purchase of paper bags. This is modeled after the Bellingham proposal that won passage by voters this summer. Unlike the 20-cent fee that was proposed by the city council last year, that would have levied a 20-cent fee for any disposable bag used in the city of Seattle, that the retailers would have to remit most of the fee back to the city, which made voters in Seattle think, oh, this is another new tax, et cetera, and brought the Chemical Industry Council out of the woodwork, and they dumped a whole bunch of money into that election.
It wasn't just that most of voters thought that it was a new tax. They had a lot of help in that thinking.
Yes, they did. This one isn't likely to garner that much attention. Plastic bag bans have passed elsewhere in the U.S. without the Chemistry Council jumping on top of them. So
we should also point out that there are 9 members on City Council, and 6 of them co-sponsored this. So unless somebody changes their mind, a couple somebody's changed their mind, this is almost assured of passage.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Governor Greg Waugh.
Yeah, earlier this year, Governor Greg Waugh proposed she released her new state budget proposal about a month or so ago, and it was an all-cuts state budget. At that time, she said, well, we're only looking at the expense side of the ledger, and I'm proposing an all-cuts budget. And she got some flack for that. Now she's come out and proposed, she's looked at the revenue side of the ledger, and she's come out and proposed a half-penny sales tax increase in order to buy back some of the cuts that she proposed in her revenue budget.
In other words,
budget.
The most regressive possible tax.
Yes, exactly. Sales tax is not levied based on your income. It's everybody pays it, whether you're high income or low income, and therefore it's a regressive tax. It would bring in about $500 million in revenue. Mostly that's going to be that would be used to buy back cuts in higher education in K-12 schools, although not all of the cuts. And it would need to be approved by the legislature by mid-December in order for it to go on the ballot for voters to decide on in March. Now, Gregoire did look at some tax loopholes, closing some tax loopholes. She looked at about 185 different tax loopholes and potential tax increases other than the sales tax increase, but she only proposed closing about 13 tax loopholes, and of course this would require a two-thirds vote by the legislature to pass, and so she's not expecting it those to pass, but the halfpenny sales tax increase would, she assumes, would pass. I don't really understand that reasoning, because here in the city of Seattle, a halfpenny sales tax increase would increase our sales tax in the city to 10%. You look at that and you go, okay, that might increase your revenue slightly for a year or two, but what's the impact going to be on retail sales? Come on, you know, 70 to 80% of economic activity in the United States is based on retail sales. So if you do something that's going to impinge on that, it's as if you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, and there's nothing that would prevent her also from taking some of those tax loopholes and putting those on the ballot as well.
Yeah.
Because it only requires a majority vote by the legislature to put them on the ballot.
I think she should have looked at one or two of those really big ones and put those on the ballot instead.
All right. Also, coming up this next week is a special session in Olympia.
Well, yeah, that's what they're going to talk about. And the deal with the special session, they're ostensibly there to talk about the budget, but any kind of bill can be introduced. And then they're going to have to turn around in January also with their regular budget and come up with a biennial budget that bridges even more of a gap. The shortfall that they have in the budget is for the coming calendar year, the rest of the current biennial budget, but they've still got two more years to worry about after that. So this is just the beginning of the cuts that we're going to hear about, and there's going to be a lot more pain. And you know, the fat has already been trimmed off the budgets here. We're talking really serious cuts that are going to affect a lot of people, and the whole idea that you know, the only way they can figure out to raise revenue is the most aggressive possible form is just a serious abdication of the responsibility of the politicians.
Yeah. Javan, I think you've said before, Gregoire is not running for re-election, so you would think now is the time for her to take a stand and say, gosh, let's do something that would really help fix our problems, even if it's controversial. But she hasn't done that.
No, she hasn't.
And I know the Occupy movement is planning on heading down to Olympia.
Yeah, there will be demonstrations down there on Monday for the beginning of the special session.
All right. Well, related to the Occupy movement, Seattle Central sounds like it's the decision makers at Seattle Central sound like they've come up with something this week.
Something is right. The trustees at Seattle Central have decided to ban camping this week, which would give them the authority to evict the Occupy Seattle encampment that's been on the SCCC grounds for the last month or so. Now, this is something that SCCC leadership has been looking for a legal rationale to possibly kick them off, even though the encampment has the support of a lot of the faculty and teachers and some of the students as well at SCCC. But, you know, the usual things are being cited. There are individuals here and there attracted to the encampment who might have substance abuse problems or there might be violent crime. And of course there would be substance abuse problems and violent crime even without the presence of that encampment. But this is the justification that's being used. The question now is where next for Occupy Seattle, and several possibilities have been floated. There have been different foreclosed properties around the area that have been mentioned as possible targets. Gasworks Park has been mentioned as a possible target. But we'll just have to wait and see. We'll see where it goes. But the one thing that's very clear is that the encampment is not going to go away.
But Gasworks Park, of course, is not a foreclosed property.
No, it's not. It's just highly contaminated.
Yeah.
But once again, it's a city park, so it takes them out of the realm of the school and puts them back into the hands pretty much of the mayor and the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah, although in this case the mayor and the police department wouldn't be facing the pressure from downtown merchants that they were when they were at Westlake.
Yes, that's true.
But it's also an area that's far, far away from visibility of anybody who's passing by.
Yeah, at the city level, it's kind of bringing fireworks to the park at a different time of the year.
Yeah.
something like that, yeah.
All right. Let's move on then to national, and I know you were both out yesterday, doing a lot of shopping.
I was. I brought my pepper spray. I was prepared.
Oh, thank you, Chad.
And I cleared the aisle. By God, I got those video consoles.
I think everybody was pretty appalled to turn on the news on Friday and see that overnight, with some stores opening at midnight on Thursday,
or 10 p.m. Wednesday night,
or 9 p.m. yeah, Wednesday night, that some of the folks who had lined up got to go inside when the stores opened and to get the best deals on the lowest quality items, because that's usually what's put on sale with those deep discounts on, and they don't tell you that on Black Friday, on their Black Friday specials. Sure, you can get a $200 flat screen TV, but how long is it going to last you? Maybe 2 months. Those folks who lined up for that kind of crap, they got a little fractious, and one woman pulled out a canister and pepper sprayed people so that she could get her hands on a video game cartridge.
A woman had a couple of kids in tow, reportedly.
Yes, and you know, I look at that kind of thing, and I just kind of shrug my shoulders, and I think, you know, what can you expect when you have the TV news anchors showing videotape of protesters being indiscriminately pepper sprayed by police? And not making any comment on it
in the case of Fox News, saying, well, it's basically a food product.
Exactly. You know, as if it were a normal thing they're not really hurting these people. Then of course you're going to get this kind of a situation where ordinary person says, well, I can use, if the police can do that, I can do that too. Disgusting.
It is disgusting. A couple other thoughts on that. Number one, for several years now, we've been seeing these melees around artificially created shopping deadlines of, you know, the first 50 people at X o'clock in the middle of the night get a special deal on some hot item. And really, it's the merchants and especially the big box stores that are creating this kind of artificial stampede. And they're really responsible. And quite frankly, I hope in this case, the retailers, Walmart, although other retailers have done it too, I hope they get sued. I really do, because they created this situation and their security didn't do nearly enough to try and prevent it from happening. That being said, we have a situation where, you know, the EU is falling apart. We've got unrest in the Middle East. We've got very serious problems here at home, and this is what people are worried about in the evening news.
Yeah.
All right.
It's Black Friday.
Let's move on and talk about third quarter profits.
Oh yeah, speaking of the Occupy movement, and the FDIC came out with a report yesterday that third quarter bank profits were the highest they've been in 4 years, $35.3 billion. Now this because a lot of the write downs that banks had been forced to do over the last several years with the economy, they've been doing less of that over the third quarter, and so they're doing quite well for themselves. Now, you may ask yourself, well, why, if the banks are doing record profits, are they doing things like trying to charge money on debit card fees and other service charges like that? And of course, the simple answer to that is because they can.
Well, and because it helps them maintain those profits and reach new records every year.
Why do you think they're rich?
Yeah, and this is a theme that I've visited, you know, before, is that we're going to have to get used to, and I think investors have to get used to, slow growth and the benefits and I think that it's natural for an economy, and perhaps humane for an economy, to have very slow and incremental growth, not very slow in very small increments of growth, and not, you know, wild, exuberant record levels of growth every quarter. I think that's where you start to wonder, okay, is this all based on a fantasy? Is this all based on hysteria and hype? You know, and that's what we saw in the last decade. And of course, we're recovering from that. Small growth is where I think the economy should be. And that's what it's doing right now. And yet investors are punishing companies that show only small levels of growth, and they are still rewarding companies like these big banks that show record profits. And of course, in order to show those record profits quarter after quarter, they have to do pretty terrible things like push for higher and higher fees and more fees on more and more things.
And didn't, according to one of our guests at 7:30, didn't Bank of America lay off like 30,000 people during that quarter?
Yeah, oh, yes.
They certainly did. So, that's one of the things that they do to make the balance sheet show better. Every time I hear a discussion like that, I think of the old Edward Abbey quote that unrestrained growth is the ideology of the cancer cell.
Yes. Very good point, Jeff.
All right. Well, moving on to down in Oregon, the governor there.
Yes, Governor John Kitzhaber stopped an execution that was scheduled for Oregon and basically said he would no longer sign off on the death penalty while he is in office down there. He cited several reasons for this. He cited the cost. He cited the direct quote is, Oregon has an expensive and unworkable system that fails to meet basic standards of justice. And he also pointed something else out that is not the case in some death penalty states, but it is in Oregon and also is in Washington State, which is that because of the cost of the different appeals, usually the only people who wind up getting executed are the people who want to be executed, who drop all of their appeals. That was the case in Oregon. That's been the case for the last several years in terms of the dozen or so people who are on death row in Washington State. And it raises the question, again, because Christine Gregoire is not running for re-election, if this can happen in Oregon, where there's widespread public opposition to the death penalty, as there is in Washington State, why can't it happen here?
Yeah, death penalty cases are extremely expensive for the public to pay for, millions of dollars in the case of each individual case. So I'm sure much of Kitzhaber's decision was based on the budgetary considerations.
Yeah, my understanding is just looking at the financial end of this is that it's more expensive to pursue the death penalty than to keep someone in prison for the rest
for life.
Of their
lives.
That's absolutely
yes.
Correct, yeah.
I mean, you're not paying millions and millions of dollars to keep them in prison for life, but to litigate a death penalty case, oh, yes.
All right. Moving on to amazing acts of Congress.
Well, amazing is one term for it. Congress is part of its attack on standards that were adopted earlier this year by the Department of Agriculture. Their lobbyist and corporate-induced wisdom, they have decided that pizza is a vegetable for the purposes of school lunch. Well, not pizza is not a vegetable, but the sugar-themed, the tomato-themed sugar paste that they put on pizzas, that is considered a vegetable. Now, folks who are a little bit older might remember in the 1980s when the Reagan administration took a lot of flack for trying to name ketchup as a vegetable in school lunches. This is actually arguably worse.
Yes.
Because it's not just the tomato-themed sugar paste being named a vegetable, but it's tomato-themed sugar paste that comes on a dough and sodium, which I believe are the other and cheese, which are the
dough
other major...
Dough and sodium and high-fat cheese, yes.
Cheese product, actually.
Yes.
probably not real cheese. And this is the sort of thing that passes for kids' nutritional lunches in public schools. It's really pretty appalling. But it wasn't the only thing that Congress did as part of this. They also repealed limits on starch in school lunches, thanks to the potato lobby, and sodium due to the salt lobby and the agricultural lobby, so that students can get all the sodium and all the starch that they want, and they can get their daily vegetable requirements through tomato themed sugar paste.
Yeah, that's the new food pyramid, isn't it? With sugar at the base and starch in the middle and salt at the top.
Yeah.
And I think we had on a recent broadcast that Thomas Lindsay mentioned that I believe cheese in this country, somewhere 60-70% of it now is produced exclusively by Kraft. So you know mm-hmm. that Kraft is synonymous with quality, right?
Yes, and I thought you were going to say produced by cows, but that's probably not accurate.
No, I can assure you that's not. Cows are pretty much out of the loop at this point.
Well, and that shows you that, you know, these are enormously large companies that are lobbying for these things. It makes it easier for them to, it makes it easier for one or two companies to agree to spend the tons and tons of money to lobby to get the law changed. than it is for lots and lots of small companies.
Yeah, and again, you're talking about the pressure for companies to produce short-term profits, and it's much cheaper to invest in a member or several hundred members of Congress than it is to actually use higher quality ingredients.
All right.
Because you'd be surprised how cheaply our politicians can be bought.
Yes.
Well, speaking of which, that wasn't all that Congress did this week.
No, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, put in a request that was actually budget neutral to create a national climate service similar to the National Weather Service that would provide climate data for things like the military and for farmers and so forth because of long-range changes to the climate, people not knowing when things should be planted now, what the effect on different species can be, that sort of thing. Well, this was blocked, of course, by congressional Republicans who were worried that it could provide facts about the climate, which in turn could be used to provide, conclusions. And that in turn might cause people to, think. it really is kind of appalling when the only thing Congress can be mobilized to do is to prevent actual facts from being gathered that would encourage informed decisions, because God forbid we can't have that.
And you can't have people talking about the climate.
No, nope. It used to be when you want to talk about something safe, you would talk about the weather, but not anymore.
No.
All right. Well, speaking of which, and moving on to international, it appears something has come back to haunt us.
Yes. This week, another round of ClimateGate emails was released anonymously. Folks might remember the original ClimateGate emails that were stolen from the University of East Anglia in the UK and released to the public to try to embarrass climate scientists and to try to prove, although they didn't do that, that climate science is, and global warming is not factual, that these guys were perpetrating some kind of a fraud.
And there were a number of investigations that showed, in fact, that no fraud was being perpetrated and everything was on the level.
Yeah, so a new batch of more than 5,000 emails, which is evidently, they're all evidently emails that were stolen in the interim, some of them at the same time as the earlier batch, have been released, and they've been released to be timed with the new climate conference set to start next week in Durban, South Africa. And so I think it would be nice if the media, instead of just looking at the emails and saying, you know, is global warming real? Do these guys really believe what they're telling us? Instead of doing that, that they would ask the very serious question of who is doing this, and how are they getting the money to do this, and why? In terms of releasing these emails, stealing and releasing these emails.
All right. Moving on to Egypt.
Yeah, violence in Egypt this week, where the military government attacked demonstrators in Tahrir Square. According to General Saeed Abbas, a member of the military council, he said, quote, there is an invisible hand in the square causing a rift between the army and the people. The military council has not admitted that they have attacked demonstrators, even though doctors at nearby hospitals say that at least 41 people have died in the past week, more than a dozen of them shot with live ammunition.
I was going to say, I don't think it's an invisible hand so much as a trigger finger.
Yes, an invisible trigger finger. As well as thousands of people injured, a lot of them hit with tear gas that apparently or may have had a nerve agent included, because it has sent demonstrators into convulsions when they've inhaled it. The civilian cabinet that gave a veneer to the military council has resigned. Elections, of course, in Egypt are scheduled for Monday. This week, some of the more credible parties that had formed in the wake of Mubarak's ouster have decided to boycott Monday's elections, and it raises the question, this violence being perpetrated by a quote-unquote invisible hand in Tahrir Square, is this the military's bid to try to postpone or put off or delegitimize the elections so that they can hold on to power?
All right. Yemen.
Yeah, Yemen. The President Ali Abdullah Saleh finally resigned on Wednesday, transferring power to his vice president. And, of course, the rest of his government remained in power. His government, of course, formed through nepotism includes a lot of his family members. Now, he's the fourth leader of an Arab nation to be forced from power this year. However, Saleh isn't completely gone. He still will retain a role in the government as it goes through its transition. I want to just very briefly contrast this to what happened to Muammar Gaddafi and ask the question, well, what's the difference between Muammar Gaddafi and Ali Abdullah Saleh? Well, the difference is, of course, that Saleh was our ally and Gaddafi was not.
All right. And Bahrain.
And in Bahrain, another one of our allies in the Middle East, was found to have used excessive force against protesters in February and March of this year, according to an independent commission that had been appointed to look at the police and military response in Bahrain to peaceful demonstrators who were dispersed from the main square in the capital of Bahrain. This commission included a lot of international legal experts. They found that the Bahraini police and military tortured detainees and that they used a disproportionate use of firearms against peaceful protesters. The report is 489 pages long. They interviewed about 5,000 people, and it's the first comprehensive study of any of this year's Arab uprisings, so it's worth looking at. Torture of detainees included electric shock and beating with rubber hoses and wires. 2,929 people were arrested, and more than 700 of those people remain in prison. Now, some of the opposition in Yemen does not like this report because it doesn't look at any of the policies that led to the torture of detainees. It doesn't look at the doctors who were arrested for treating demonstrators who were injured. It doesn't look at the fact that many of Bahrain's intelligentsia were fired from their positions at universities because they supported the demonstrators. And it cited no personnel who were government personnel who were responsible for this act, for these actions. But that's one conflict in the Middle East that's not getting covered in the U.S. press, even though the U.S. has a major military naval base in Bahrain and is largely responsible for supporting the absolute monarchy in that country.
And I'm sure SPD is looking over that report now, trying to pick up tips.
Yes.
All right. And briefly, Washington Post.
Yeah, interesting story in the Washington Post this week. Ayman al-Zawahiri and his second-in-command, Abu Yahya al-Libi, are the last remaining high-value targets of the CIA's drone campaign against Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. That's right. We've basically run out of people to kill in Pakistan, at least
Al-Qaeda
people to kill.
Which raises the question of who are we really fighting there?
Well, it raises a couple questions. Number one, we continue to kill people, but an awful lot of them are civilians. And interesting, yes. in the Washington Post story, the military is justifying the continued presence of the drones and shooting there by saying, well, yes, we've killed almost all of the leadership of Al-Qaeda, but we still have the base to worry about. So let me get this straight. You're going to you've now successfully decapitated the organization. You're going to undercut all the remaining support for it by simply killing everybody. That's going to work real well.
Yeah. No, the U.S. isn't really fighting Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Who they're fighting is the Taliban, and the Taliban has broad mass support. In other words, it's a war against the indigenous population of those areas of the world.
Events.
Several events coming up this week, starting with, my page is sticking here. Monday, there will be an interfaith panel discussion with the Occupy movement that will be moderated by author Paul Loeb. That's happening from 7 to 9 o'clock on Monday at University Temple United Methodist Church at 14th and 43rd Northeast in the U District. On Wednesday, November 30th, will be the 12th anniversary of the WTO demonstrations, and the Washington Free Trade Coalition will be marking that with a celebration and annual event that will be held at 6 o'clock at UFCW Local 21, 5031st Avenue South, Suite 200. Thursday, December 1st, World's AIDS Day, there will be a fundraising dinner at 6:30 for Nova High School students traveling to Guatemala and also for scholarships for students in Guatemala. And then on Friday, December 2nd, the Occupy Movement and the Police Response will be a forum at Trinity United Methodist Church, 7 o'clock at 23rd and 65th Northwest in Ballard. So last year to keep busy this week.
As well as also that night event at St. Mark's starting at 7:30 on a collision course, Israel, Iran, and the U.S. talked by Richard Silverstein.
Yes, that's an excellent one as well.
Professor Mohammed Sahimi.
Yes, thank you.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. You find it in the virtual world online. That's where you find it.
A series of tubes.
Yes.